welcome to On the Record with Furniture Today, a podcast that goes behind the headlines to look at the news and the newsmakers, the people and the personalities that give the furniture industry its unique flavor. I'm your host, Bill McLaughlin, Editor-in-Chief of Furniture Today.
Hey, I'm Trisha Yearwood, here in Hollywood at the legendary Capitol Studios. If you're in High Point for the furniture market, be sure to stop by Klausner Home Furnishings, your one-stop shopping destination for everything furniture, including Nashville, the latest addition to my Trisha Yearwood home collection. You'll find something for every room, all of it inspired by my love of home, family, and friends, and what I call a recipe for comfortable living.
Come see the entire collection at Klausner, 101 North Hamilton.
Welcome to On the Record. I'm Bill McLaughlin, your host. I'm here this week with George Revington, former COO of Hooker Furniture, and before that, CEO of Home Meridian. Welcome, George.
Thank you, Bill. It's nice to be here. Look forward to it.
So you have had one of the shortest retirements in history. You already have got a new venture. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, I'm excited to join Kaiser Furniture in Vietnam. Charles Lowe has been a friend for almost 30 years, and they run one of the largest factories in Vietnam. And I'm going to join them as a strategic officer and help them position their company going forward. So questions about what customer base, what product classes, what channels of distribution, those are the kind of questions that if you get them right, that over a period of 3 to 5 years can make a huge difference in your performance. So I'm just going to begin that at the April market. And excited to do it. And it's not a full-time job, but it's a significant role, I think. And I hope to make a difference for them.
What made you decide to come back and take on that kind of an opportunity?
Well, I wanted to do something with somebody who's successful. And I wanted to do something where it would make a difference. And I wanted to do it with somebody who I respected. And they qualify for all of those things. I'm not sure being a CEO is a 130% all-in job. Not quite ready for that, and I have a non-compete which would prevent it. So this is a nice way to participate and be involved in the industry. I can travel to Vietnam, which is great, and understand what's going on. They're a wonderful company. Charles has consistently had a vision of the future that worked all the way back to the original tariff issue. He made huge investment in Vietnam. And if you look at it, everybody today is scampering to go to Vietnam. Kaiser has one of the biggest, most beautiful factories there already. So they're well positioned from that standpoint. In addition, they have another factory, Factory 2, which is just opening that they've been working on for more than a year. So they've got enormous capacity. And if you look at how they've positioned themselves, industry kind of broken down into wood guys and upholstery guys and metal guys. And they're one of the few factories over there that can successfully integrate materials. So they can do upholstery, they can do metal, they do fabulous finishes. So positioned for upper better goods, they're really well positioned. It'll be fun. They're really smart, nice people too, all of them.
So you mentioned they went there. You mentioned the tariffs. You meant the duties back in the
yes.
The anti-dumping duties, yeah. But they're not just case goods. They do upholstery and, as you said, mixed media. Vietnam is not necessarily known for metal. That's a unique skill in that market, isn't it?
I think it is. So many of the new styles require integration, multimedia integration, and it's very hard to get it done in Vietnam. And Kaiser's really nicely positioned to integrate metal, stone, other materials into these wonderful kind of contemporary designs that are taking place. They're really great people. One of my favorite stories is when they moved to Vietnam, it was in a hurry, and they had a wonderful ceremony to break the ribbon on the groundbreaking for the factory. And I was there and I gave a speech in English. It was short and effective. And in the background, the motor graders were roaring up and down the field, throwing up this cloud of dust that came over the crowd. So they didn't even turn the motor graders off to cut the ribbon. They don't mess around.
They were really serious.
They were serious. It was a really wonderful moment, and I was honored to be there when they cut the ribbon on the groundbreaking. So,
what do you think their opportunity is now, given the current state of the furniture business? What do you think the opportunity is for them?
Well, they're just so tremendously well positioned because they have the right customer base now. They have capacity. They can do multimedia. And it's always been true that doing business in China was going to be more difficult. But with the tariff issue, the current tariff issues and the uncertainties, the people are just flocking to Vietnam trying to resource things. It's almost not logically possible what people are trying to do. And the thing you need to remember, it's not just the furniture business. It's all those businesses in different categories are trying to move to Vietnam. And if you're not already there, and if you're not already doing it, and if you don't already have the infrastructure, it just may not be that easy. When we did it initially, it was a blank slate. It's not a blank slate anymore. It's a happening place, and it's not going to be that easy for people just to move to Vietnam.
Well, you've been there. You've seen the infrastructure. Can the infrastructure support all of the activity that we're seeing there in terms of factories being built? I mean, how do the goods get from the factory to the port and then out?
Well, I'm happy to report that there is a bridge over the river now, so at least you can get out of the city. I don't know the answer to that. I'll tell you one thing. They always seem to get it done. When we first went there, there was no way to move those containers, and now they move them every day. They'll find a way to do it. They'll find a way. Hmm. It may not be pretty, and it may not be. They'll find a way.
That's
they always have.
So speaking of finding a way, you have found your way back into the industry after 8 months of retirement. But when we were talking before we sat down and turned the audio on, you were talking about you actually had your first year and a half of retirement scripted.
Yes, so when I did leave Hooker and Home Radiant, that's a pretty big change. That's a very intense environment, wonderful people, wonderful company. But you kind of get hooked, get an adrenaline hook on the action. And I was right in the middle of it, and it was great fun. And so my biggest concern was that if I quit working, that I would get bored. And so I scripted the first year and a half of my retirement, and I'm 8 months in. So far I've had a fabulous time. I've ridden a motorcycle across Mongolia and been to the Golden Eagle Festival. I've been to Alaska fly fishing with my own airplane. I've ridden in Switzerland and Germany. What else have I done? I just got back from a 28-day motorcycle trip from Greensboro to Newport Beach to Monterey to Santa Barbara to Phoenix to Greensboro with my wife, which was really fun. And then the big event, the one that I actually planned before I left, is in April, I'm going to leave London, England with a group of about 15 people from all over the country. And we're going to ride the Southern Silk Road, which is 13,000 miles. And we will literally ride from London to Beijing, China. And it will go through all across Turkey, all across Turkmenistan, through Kazakhstan. It'll do Tibet. It'll do the Himalayan Plateau, come down to Xi'an. And it's about as long and difficult as an adventure trip as you can take. So I'm very excited about that. I've been packing every day because you have to take everything with you. I get about as much stuff that will go into a breadbasket, and that's all you get.
Okay, so I'm really curious. I have to ask, what are you bringing? How do you sit down and cull down all of that stuff? Because it's all what you can fit on the bike, right? It's just that, like, 6-liter.
That's a little embarrassing, but I have 4 shirts, 2 pair of pants, 4 pair of socks, 3 pair of underwear, 2 shoes, 1 belt. That's all I've got. I've got a jacket, 3 pair of gloves, pretty minimal. You have to take all your medicines. I got a box of medicines. I got a box of tools. It's pretty minimal.
It really is. Although you were saying your phone is actually one of the most important things that you bring.
Yeah, ironically. The phone is everything. It's the connection to the outside world. It's navigation. It's exchange. It's photographs. It's all the data will be stored on the phone. So the phone is really important. I've got an amazing amount of electronics. I've got a phone. I've got a GPS. I have a Garmin Mini in case I crash. You hit a button and it sends an SOS sign. I've got a heated vest that's Bluetooth. I've got a GoPro that's good Bluetooth. I'm going to be a Bluetooth bubble as I go across 10 minutes. And I kind of wish I had my IT staff to help me get all this stuff to work at one time.
You had to convince one of them to take the bike ride with you.
I need a consultant to get all the Bluetooth to go. I think if I turned it off and just rode, I'll be fine. But it's kind of fun.
Well, you record a lot of this that you do, right? I mean, you did the same thing in Mongolia?
Well, when I was a CEO, I did not participate in social media. Just a little difficult. But when I retired, I have so many friends in Vietnam and China and Germany and England and all around the world, and it's hard to stay in touch with them. And in Mongolia. So I started posting on Facebook, which has been, and Instagram, which is kind of fun. And so I've developed a minor social presence to kind of keep track of everybody and to record the trips. So it's fun. I'm riding down the road in the middle of Mongolia and there's nobody there. And we stop, we're tired. And these two Mongolian gentlemen ride up wearing Dells on their bike and they don't speak any English. And so we're sharing bike stories and all. They're my Facebook friends now.
Facebook friends from Mongolia.
Two guys on a bike, riding two up, wearing Dells. So it's kind of fun.
Well, you were saying that they have Wi-Fi and have TV despite how remote it is.
It's amazing around the world. People say, well, how do they get along? But every place you go in the world, they've got to have gasoline. You got to have gasoline. So somehow I've gotten gasoline out of Coke cans before. But they have gasoline and they have internet connection. And we were staying in a gare in nowhere, Mongolia, and the gentleman's got a solar panel and a dish. And we asked him what he did with it. And he said, well, in the winter, it's really boring here, so we watch TV. And we said, you do? He said, what do you watch? And he said, well, we watch Shark Tank. It's our favorite show. So the world is more connected than you think it is. It's pretty connected. And the phone is a fabulous device. My Apple X is like an amazing device.
We should call Apple. That's a commercial plug for Apple right there.
Appropriately so.
Exactly. So, when you were in Mongolia, you mentioned something about a Golden Eagle Festival. What was that?
Well, in the fall, once a year, there are about 300 Kazakhs in the world who train golden eagles to hunt. And they come down out of the mountains and they all meet in this little town called Olgi. So our motorcycle trip ended in Olgi. And there were 300 crazy Kazakh eagle hunters riding horses with their eagles. And they have this contest. And they launch the eagles off the top of this mountain. And the eagles swoop down. And there's this kind of primordial call that the riders give out to call the eagle down. And they try to get them either to land on their arm while they're on the horse or to attack a rabbit that they pull behind the... It's really interesting. These are serious people with different cultures and different lives. It's really interesting.
How did you get into that as a hobby?
It's a strange hobby. Not very many people are adventure motorcycle riders, but even as a young man, I did crazy things like that. I was a guide on canoe trips for 50 days into Hudson's Bay, and I always enjoyed going far, hard places that nobody else went, like being a CEO of a furniture company.
Yeah, those two things go right together. Right?
They actually do, because they're both challenging.
Do you find that doing those kinds of trips helps you release and unwind from the furniture piece, or do you find that there's complementary skills? I mean, how did you use that when you were running big companies? So
they're both the same. They come at you very quickly, and you have to be aware and concentrated and have stamina. They both require a terrific amount of energy in the now, and it's fun.
It seems like it. I mean, when you describe the, for example, the Silk Road trip, it seems like it also takes a lot of advanced planning and a lot of thought mm-hmm. about the steps.
You know, it does. It's interesting. It does. Being able to see the future and imagine the future and commit to the future, make the investment in the future, let go of the past. These are all skill sets that are sort of in common. I think we did that well at Home Meridian. We did a really good job of imagining what was going to happen next and doing it. I think that was part of the success there.
So as you sit where you are today, that's just a perfect segue. What is the future? What does that look like?
Well, it's certainly not what happened in the past. If you keep doing what you're doing, I think you've really got big issues. But the things that have driven this industry for the last decade are basically information systems, globalization, scale. If you look at the people who have invested in those things and organized around those things, a lot of them have done pretty well. People who have organized around, for example, brands, particularly at the wholesale side, mm-hmm. and just product, haven't done as well. It's about being able to adapt really quickly to the opportunities and invest in them. I think if you just look at the growth in the industry, you know, if e-commerce is 15% of the business and it's growing at 40% a year, it's far and away more than 100% of the growth in the industry, which is really a violent change.
It is a violent change.
And if you compound it for any length of time, it's probably not sustainable, but it's also massive. But there are other effective channels. It's like the non-traditional channels, a lot of them have done well.
When you look at how the internet has changed the way furniture companies have to operate, what do you think are some of the lessons from that? What are the biggest, most disruptive, mm-hmm. probably almost invisible changes?
Yeah. So doing business in e-commerce, probably not that different. You know, it probably takes a different product, different packaging, different photography, a different sales channel, different organization, different information system, different sourcing structure, just a different customer base. Other than that, it's all the same.
Other than all of those differences, it's just the same.
That's right. And if you don't honor those differences and commit to them, you probably won't do very well.
One of the things that companies seem to wrestle with is the inventory commitment that the internet seems to require, right? Having warehousing, the ability to move product that last little bit to the retailer or have more on hand so that there's not that same lag as when you're custom ordering or, you know, the traditional time frame that you think of in the furniture business. How has it changed speed to market?
It's pretty different. The answer to your inventory question is yes. It takes a lot of inventory. And so those systems to manage the inventory and the slow moving items is really a huge part of it. But it's also a hero business. On the internet, you can have the best product in the world and the best price, and you can sell none. So it's all about hero products. So a hero product is one that's been out there, that's got great photography, got great content, and got likes, and got comments. And it takes a long time to create those. You can't create those yourself. So how do you create them? So managing inventory around the hero items, making sure you make the hero items drive your business, and then managing the rest of it can be really challenging.
Hey, I'm Trisha Yearwood, here in Hollywood at the legendary Capitol Studios. If you're in High Point for the furniture market, be sure to stop by Klausner Home Furnishings, your one-stop shopping destination for everything furniture, including Nashville, the latest addition to my Trisha Yearwood home collection. You'll find something for every room, all of it inspired by my love of home, family, and friends, and what I call a recipe for comfortable living.
Come see the entire collection at Klausner, 101 North Hamilton.
Do I misunderstand? It seems to me that the historic model is based on newness, right? I want the newest thing. It sounds to me like in that model, it actually takes, it's not about necessarily the newness, it's about building the awareness and marketing a hero, creating a hero.
You're exactly correct. And the reason I know this is because I learned the hard way.
Oh, okay.
You know, you'd think they want speed to market. They don't actually care what it is. They need the process. The process has to work. And the process is having a great product, having the right price compared to all the other prices, on, and knowing what it is, having the right promotion, having the right content, having the likes, having the inventory, and then what happens is it sells really well and you run out, and then you'll go backwards to the beginning. So being successful is a lot about managing that supply chain, and just having massive amounts of new product doesn't get you a thing. Doesn't get you a thing.
It sounds like you need to be much more focused on new kinds of marketing also. I mean, you talk about getting the likes. Well, that's a Facebook thing. That's an Instagram thing. That's not about advertising in a circular or having it in a catalog. That seems like a whole different process.
Yeah. Other than them being totally different, it's the same. I would agree.
There you have it. It's totally the same, except that it's totally different. Where do you see the business going? One of the things we were talking about before we went on air was finding niches. Mm-hmm. What do you think are the kinds of niches that could be successful going forward?
Well, by the definition of a niche, it's a small space that you define that's where you narrow the focus. And it can be really broad. I mean, people are selling pillows, they're selling mattresses direct, they're selling razors direct, they're selling underwear direct. That's one. I mean, those are really little niches. Who would have dreamt that somebody go on the internet and sell underwear? So there's that strategy. But there are lots. There's as many niches as there are ideas in the world, and then there are more. And so each one is, everybody's got to find their own and define. I don't think there's one answer to that question.
How do you balance a business that's built around niches with building scale? Everybody, when they look at creating a business model, wants to know, I mean, that seems to be the big thing. Is it scalable, right?
Yeah.
Okay, so if you build around a niche, that's by definition somewhat small, somewhat constrained. At some point, in order for somebody to maximize that or somebody to be willing to invest in that, there has to be an element of scalability. So how do you balance scalability versus that?
You know, we had that issue at Home Radio, and one of the things that happens is, you know, some people organize their business around brands, some people organize their business around products. We tried to organize our business around process, so we built an ERP system that could drive the whole industry, the whole business. And if you think about it, it was a little business with Samuel Lawrence, and then we bolted on Pulaski, and then we bolted on right to home, and then we bolted on an e-commerce business, and we bolted on a, so if you can create that kernel of operating system, a little like what you're doing in your business here, you can build scale around it. But you got to build scale around a process, because if you don't have the process, the rest of it can get pretty narrow on you.
When you say process, what do you mean specifically?
Well, it's the basic controls inside the business. It's the financial controls, it's the inventory controls, it's the service to your customers, it's the communication within your business. I mean, at Home Radian, like, everything was standardized. It was all driven on SAP. It was fabulous. And presidents of companies didn't really have to worry about it that much, because it was served up in a very professional and robust manner. And then it went from one little company to like five decent-sized companies, and now it's a pretty significant business.
We talked earlier, too, about channels and the traditional definitions of channels, and one of the things we talked about was traditional furniture stores. Mm-hmm. And for those who didn't get to listen, George corrected me, that even using that term, the definition of how you define a channel becomes so important. Can you share a little insight into for example, what you're talking about in terms of traditional furniture stores and the the incorrectness of using that term as too much of a catch-all?
Yeah. Well, if you mix black and white together, you get gray. And so if you don't get the right definitions, the right characteristics, the right drivers of a business, you won't get the right answer. And if you look at traditional furniture stores, there are a lot of ways to break them down, but one of the biggest one is just scale. Those that have scale can access direct shipments from Asia. Those that have scale can create powerful information systems. Those that have scale can advertise on a massive basis. Those that have scale can make mistakes and succeed. They can make investments and succeed. So the big regional firms, and they're really good professionally run companies, and they dominate trading areas or regions, I think are quite different than independent furniture stores where you don't have scale. And so if you don't have scale, then you really need to be carefully defining a niche that differentiates it. But if you're, I can name them, you know, they're obvious, like City Furniture and Living Spaces, and they're fabulously well-run, smart people, and they're going to do well because they have scale. They can access Asia. They have powerful information systems. They can speak to their customers. They have brand. So it's really pretty different. When you say traditional furniture stores, I think you need to separate those with scale and those who don't have scale.
For those who don't have scale, because there's still so many mom and pop, you know, smaller furniture businesses out there, when you say niche, do you mean product niche, or are there other types of niches that a smaller operator could define for themselves to kind of create a successful business?
Well, niche can be defined a lot of, can be created around a lot of different parameters. The distribution channel is obviously one. How do you distribute your product? Is it just everybody who walks in the door, or are you going out and attacking customer bases with designers? You know, is it a look? It can be based around a look. It could be based around a geography. Are you in some unusual place where people have got a different attitude about the world? That's a niche. But there's not one niche. Each niche has to be unique to the energy and the drive and the creativity of an entrepreneur, I think.
I'm almost tempted to, well, I'm going to ask the question anyway. Does it mean that product itself is less important than process? Or is having the right product still really
it's
important?
It's sort of a macro-micro question. You've got to do both. You have to do both. If you do just the product, you'll end up this big. If you do the process and the product, you'll end up doing significantly better. You'll be scalable. You'll be scalable. The neat thing about the furniture industry is that everything I say is not true because it's so diverse. it can be true one place and not true someplace else. So these are just kind of the macro visions of the thing. But they're pretty significant. If you look at the traditional companies in our industry that are not with us today, those are gargantuan shifts in position, just stunning shifts in business. And then if you look at the people like the commerce piece of it, those are just stunning shifts in business. And there are other examples of stunning shifts, like the Ashley companies are an amazing example of good execution of process and determination, I think.
I think that's one of the examples you gave of one of those process-driven companies that's managed to be very successful based around executing on a process. So if you were to project out 5 years what the furniture industry looks like, take your crystal ball out, what does the furniture industry look like? What advice would you give to somebody who's trying to be successful 5 years from now?
It's hard to say, but whatever's happening now, it's going to happen faster and more, and it's going to be based about managing information. Managing information is the whole competitive advantage in most businesses today. How do you manage information? In the furniture business, there's almost nobody in the furniture industry who's actually using AI or using modern technology to use large databases and mine it for information. I don't think there's anybody in the industry that I know of. A couple trying, but to demonstrate that they've actually created competitive advantage. But that whole part of the business in our industry is untouched, and that is where huge investments are being made. Huge investments are being made in managing large sets of data. Wayfair is doing it. Wayfair does it. And after that, there are people who are just trying to do it or starting to do it.
At that point, does AI manage inventory? Does AI determine product design? I mean, we're going to see AI-driven assortments, collections?
I think it could. Again, you got this niche thing. It's the nice thing about the furniture industry is so diverse. And so I don't think it will dominate like maybe in other industries. But still, the biggest trend in the world today is how you manage gigantic databases and how you create value from them. And we're not doing that.
No. Well, I mean, does that require a scale that doesn't yet exist in the furniture business? In order for you to have, I mean, when I think of who has a giant database, Amazon, Wayfair, maybe Ashley, I mean, there's probably only a handful of companies that have data on that scale.
Probably true. And at the same time, I got to tell you, if you intend to do something, you can find a way to do it. And there are a lot of fairly inexpensive ways to manage databases, even though they're not gargantuan. But you got to want to do it, and you got to invest in it, and you got to fail, and you got to learn how to do it. And that's kind of an abstract answer. I think that the diversity of channels of distribution will just continue to be really significant here. This thing about selling furniture without actually seeing it, that's a profound shift. That's a big shift.
A lot of people seem to still convince themselves that the consumer will not buy a piece of furniture they cannot see in person or try. Is that a myth?
So I believe that wholeheartedly. I was just dead wrong. Just completely and utterly wrong. And the only advantage I got is I admitted it. And did something about it. Because that was e-commerce was a big part of the story at Home Meridian.
Yeah, it really was.
That and other things. A lot of nice people.
Well, you stay in touch with the people. Still
I do.
Get to see them periodically.
Yeah, a lot of good friends. I'm looking forward to market, seeing everybody. It'll be fun.
And then you'll be gone for 100 days.
Yes. But I'll be posting on Facebook, so I'm available.
There you go.
Instagram.
So you're going to get a lot of friend requests after this podcast. People are going to just load down downloads to try to follow you
I'm
on Instagram
friendly.
And Facebook.
I'm very friendly. So.
Well, good. We'll have to circle back when you get back and talk some more. Thanks so much for taking the time. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. It's great to see you. It's fun. This is a fun industry with lots of really nice people in it. I'm just so fortunate to have been part of it and enjoyed every minute of it.
Well, you're not done yet?
Nope. It's all fun.